Thanks, Federico.
Thank you.
All right, finally then, we've got settled and started somewhere. As Federico says, I've come to talk to you today about my book, Recovering Bulging. So I thought I'd start with just a little few words about why I started to write the book and what happened to me when I started to write the book. And then towards the end, perhaps if we get some time, I might be able to talk about some of my later work, which was a look at the theory of bulging, bulging social ecology, as applied to Los Indignados in Madrid, the start of the Occupy movement in the West at least. Okay, so recovering bulging. Why did I write the book? What happened to me when I started writing the book? Well, I started researching bulging in 2003. Pretty soon, I was made aware, or became aware, of this really contradictory picture of Murray Bookchin. Okay, on the one hand, there was literature out there, lots of literature saying what a great contribution Bookchin had made. And I'll give you some examples here to start us off. In the early 1980s, The Ecologist, for example, in 1982, argued that Bookchin has devised the most complete statement of the anarchist vision yet produced, and he has produced an alternative to Marxism. The New Scientist in 1982 argued that the work of Bookchin can be paralleled with that of Albert Einstein's relationship to Isaac Newton, in the sense that he created a body of work that showed that the Marxist systematic was one form of analysing society, but one type of a much wider analysis, and that wider analysis was Bookchin's focus on social hierarchy. We'll come back to that later. Of course, for those of you who study anarchism, you'll know that Peter Marshall, in his Demanding the Impossible, calls Bookchin the thinker that's most renewed anarchism in the 20th century. So whenever you first approach the work of Bookchin, there's this real positive literature. By the same token, as soon as you find this positive literature, you find a negative body of literature. And I'll just give you a few quotes around from the same period on Bookchin that come from a different point of view from completely. So at the moment we're reading that Bookchin is this thinker that's devised an anarchist and ecological vision, we get accusations in the 1980s from academics and activists accusing Bookchin of ideological turf war, of accusing Bookchin of being mired in old anthropocentric narcissism, being self-absorbed. These are all direct quotations. We get discussions of Bookchin's vehemence and viciousness. We get accusations of Bookchin of being of suffering from sour grapes and trying to control the ecology movement, the emergent ecology movement, and it goes on and on. We move into the 90s, we get even worse accusations against Bookchin of famously being an old man, desperate to cash in his chips and dominate the resurgent anarchist movement. So you get this contradictory picture. At first, I wanted to ignore all of that negative literature and just focus on Bookchin's work and focus on what his contribution was, but it was impossible. Every turn, that literature was there. Every turn, in every conference you went to, somebody brought up this literature. The final conference that I went to that decided that I would take a different tack with the book, it's no exaggeration to say that one of the people in the audience actually shadowboxed as they described what Bookchin was like. Accused Bookchin of being this pugilistic, aggressive, fighting thinker, not interested in any of the ideas that he'd been writing about for years, but interested in some kind of political manoeuvre. So that then led to Recovering Bookchin, an attempt to recover Bookchin from his problematic body of literature. From that, I decided, and I describe in the book, that the negative body of work on Bookchin has created what I call the Bookchin caricature. It's a caricature of Bookchin. It reduces all of his work to this one simplistic notion of him as a polemicist, which he was, as him as being a vocal critic of other strands of the movement, which he was, but it caricatures him in such an extent that people lose focus on the ideas and focus on Bookchin, Bookchin's personality, perhaps his personal failings. Therefore, the book is about dispelling the Bookchin caricature. Dispelling the caricature in the first instance and then moving on to look at the theory. Now, normally I explain where that caricature came from here, and that's what I do in the book, and then move on to the theory. But I thought today I'd do it the other way around. I'll start today by looking at what I've called the central motor of Bookchin's theory of society, of nature, of politics. There's a central motor that drives the rest of his work. And we'll come back to why I call it central motor in a short while, but we'll just go on to look at Bookchin's view of society, nature, civilization, and of course, all of this leads to a critique of current ecological and environmental problems. Bookchin has a very rounded critique of why we're in this position, why we have the ecological crisis, and how we can get out of it. Okay, so to do this, obviously we're doing this as briefly and as quickly as I can today. I want to then split our look at his theory into two parts to start with. Okay, the first is his eco-philosophy, we could argue, his ecology, strictly speaking, what he thinks of ecology as widely conceived as we can think of. And second is, from that, his understanding of history. His understanding of history, combined with his eco-philosophy, gives us his version of society, his version of why we are in the state we're in today, and also gives us his version of what to do about that, of how to enact social change. We'll come back to that. Okay, so his eco-philosophy, and really, really quickly, we'll fly through this. Bookchin argues, I'm sure there are many other thinkers that argue similar things, but Bookchin was arguing this in the 70s and 80s, quite a forward-thinking philosophy in many ways, and he argues that ecology as a whole, evolution as a whole, is importantly one set of processes. One set of processes, but in the processes of evolution, there are two differentiations. Okay, this will be important when we think about his critique a little later on. So it's one evolution, two differentiations. One nature, two differentiations. Those two differentiations for Bookchin are first nature, which is the whole of evolution, including human society, and second nature, which is human society alone. So first nature and second nature. Okay, they're all part, though, of one evolutionary process. And again, this can be important a little later on. But this evolutionary process, Bookchin argues, and it's interesting to know that in the 30 or 40 years since Bookchin started to elucidate these ideas, time and time again, the science seems to be backing it up. Okay, the science of ecology and the look at evolution seems to be backing up increasingly. Okay, so one evolution, two differentiations. The two differentiations, first nature and second nature, are part of the same process. Indeed, for Bookchin, second nature is a direct product of first nature. It's absolutely logical that second nature, human society, everything we've got today in the industrial world, post-industrial world, whatever you want to call it, is a product of the operating forces in nature as a whole. Those operating forces for Bookchin are things like constant striving across all of nature for increased complexity, for increasing diversity, for a diversity of life forms. The diversity of life forms leads to increasing complexity. So ecosystems grow, become more complex and more successful. Again, Bookchin is saying all the time here that as they become more successful, the peak, the top end of each ecosystem produces the most advanced form of that striving. If we take evolution as a whole, that peak is human society. And obviously, we'll come back in a second to why human society has failed this role so miserably, it seems, at present. But for Bookchin, it's important to know that we have this one evolution, one striving evolution for increased diversity, increased complexity. Out of this complexity and diversity, Bookchin states and argues that the other key characteristic that we can see, if we take this long view, is participation. That the more complex ecosystems become, the more diverse they become, the more opportunities there are for life forms to, inverted commas, participate. And even at the lower end of this scale, there's a very simple ecosystem. Becomes more complex and diversifies. At the very lower end, there are still more, what Bookchin calls, dim choices for life forms within that ecosystem. So, you know, we can use lots of really simple analogies, but as a plant enacts with, for argument's sake, 10 other beings in a really basic ecosystem, it has 10 evolutionary pathways. If that ecosystem currently suddenly has 20 other life forms, it has 20 evolutionary pathways. For Bookchin, this is the first emergence of dim choice, of a dim choice of life forms of interacting and having different routes through their lifespan. That dim choice, again I'm reducing massively here, but that dim choice ultimately becomes complex as we move, more complex as we move up the evolutionary chain, and ultimately, after much history we know, results in human consciousness. There is a continuity between dim choice, the dim choice of life forms in these ecosystems, and human consciousness. Okay, all of this is to say that for Bookchin, there is nothing antagonistic in evolution as a whole between humanity and nature. Even between life forms, despite the fact that we have predation. Even predation, prey and predator, is at all part of the same move towards increasingly complex ecosystems. Therefore, there is nothing for Bookchin antagonistic between human society and the rest of evolution. Everything that we have in society is a product of this one striving. Of course, differentiated into first and second nature. All right, then, and that brings us on to part two of Bookchin's eco-philosophy. If Bookchin is right here, and ecosystems and evolution as a whole are complementary, they're about diversity, they're about increasing complexity, they're about participation, then what's gone wrong is the obvious question. If it's all about this beautiful flowering of life in an ecosystem that's perfectly balanced and successful, then what's gone wrong in human society? And this brings us to Bookchin's version of social history, his analysis of social history. Bookchin argues, like most political theorists do, that somewhere along the lines, there has been a separation of humanity from the rest of evolution. And that separation doesn't necessarily need to be antagonistic, as we've seen, with Bookchin's two differentiations, one nature. But the second nature, human society, has at some stage developed highly aberrant forms. Okay, it's developed highly aberrant forms. And these, for Bookchin, are hierarchy and domination. It's the development of hierarchy and domination. Now, we have to remember when we look at Bookchin's social history, he's comparing it and drawing it out against the Marxist version of social history in the first instance. And this is where I think Bookchin's work becomes interesting. This is interesting. This is where we can see this original contribution. Bookchin claims that Marx, like most Western political theory, most 17th, 18th and 19th political theory and social theory, Marx claims that humanity moves through society through, as we know, first a division of labour, then a production of a surplus, then a move to agricultural society, and out of that move, particularly important, is the emergence of the surplus, we begin to see the emergence of one group in society dominating another. We begin, in short, to see the emergence of class. The surplus emerges, one group controls the surplus and dominates the rest. Okay. Now, why does the surplus emerge? Well, we know again for Marx it's about the division of labour. We know for other thinkers who don't go into so much detail, it's about, in short, human society developing ever more intelligent and clever ways to extract more from the natural world. Okay, to extract more from the natural world, to produce the surplus, so agriculture, whatever it might be. For many thinkers, Marx includes, it means that human society learns to dominate the natural world. It's no longer at the whims of the natural world, it's no longer at the whims of nature, it learns to protect itself from nature, then to extract more, then ultimately to extract a surplus, to become sedentary, everything we know about surplus. Okay. Bookchin calls this, and you'll see this if you look at his early work, Bookchin calls this the obsession with scarcity, in most social thought, that human societies face scarcity, fight against the scarce existence, and produce a surplus. Once the surplus is produced, one group emerges, dominates the rest, several groups emerge, dominate the rest, and we get the emergence of domination in society. Domination through class. Okay, hierarchy comes along at the same time. But Bookchin says, to view the world that way leads us to all of our current problems. Or to view history that way leads us to all of our current problems. Not just social problems, but ecological problems too. And remember, Bookchin and social ecology is constantly fighting these two fronts, if you like. He's constantly trying to provide us a critique of what's gone wrong in human society, what's gone wrong in second nature. He's constantly trying to find us a critique of what's gone wrong in the relationship between second nature and first nature. So Bookchin says, we must go back to look at this mindset of overcoming scarcity, dominating the natural world, and dominating each other. And he argues, actually, that it's in reverse. That the reverse is true. Okay, that first, domination emerges outside of a relationship to the natural world. We know that's not possible, but it emerges between human beings first. Hierarchy and domination emerges in human societies first. Okay? We learn how to dominate each other, and then we project the notion of domination onto the natural world. We try to dominate the natural world. Okay? So domination comes first. For Bookchin, and in fact, okay, for Bookchin, I'll tell you this first. For Bookchin, domination first emerges in society in one particular group, and that's in the gerontocracy. It's the rule of the old, and Bookchin argues that the ethnographic and anthropological study of many tribal societies show that the old, once they become non-reproductive and non-productive, are often the first to suffer. You know, they're often the first left behind when groups move on, and they carve out, over long periods of history, a distinct role for themselves. It's got nothing to do with production, nothing to do with reproduction, and it's about the monopolisation of wisdom, it's about shamanism, it's about all of those kind of things. As I was going to say, that is challenged and can be challenged by anthropological and ethnographic studies. There are different places where we can put the emergence of hierarchy and domination. I would say, I'm trying to understand Bookchin and this central motor, whether it's right or wrong, the gerontocracy is not the important point. It's a debate that should be had, but it's not the important point. What is the important point is the way we see hierarchy emerging pre the emergence of the surplus. Okay, hierarchy emerging pre the surplus. Why? Well, again, this is what I've called the central motor. Bookchin says that if we change our mindset, that if we think we dominated each other first, we have a solution, or we have at least the start, the opening point for solutions to our problems today. Because first, if we think that domination becomes first in society, then we know that any project to overcome the problems of society must deal with domination and hierarchy at the deepest level. So it's not just about economic hierarchy and economic domination. It's not just about political hierarchy, political domination. It's an analysis of hierarchy and domination in every aspect of society. In fact, Bookchin calls it a mindset. There is a subjectivity of domination, and it's that which needs to be challenged. And in this, he shares a lot of similarities with other thinkers from the 50s and 60s who were working in similar fields, although in quite different ways. For example, the Frankfurt School, some of the Frankfurt School thinkers, and their focus on hierarchy outside of strict economic hierarchy. So in the first instance, that tells us that we need to analyse and act upon these much deeper hierarchies, these hierarchies that aren't necessarily related to class, that aren't necessarily related to redistribution of resources, something more fundamental. That's the first thing it does for us. The second thing the central motor does for us is it allows us again to rethink the reasons for our problematic relation to the natural world, our problematic relationship with the natural world. Okay? If hierarchy and domination emerge in human society first, and then we project them onto the natural world, it leads us in the first instance to realise that there is no such thing as domination or even full command of natural resources. And we see that ourselves today more than ever. That the idea of domination, dominating nature, is always just that. It was an idea. It was an idea, a mistaken idea. Whereas Bookchin argues, if we go back to the other version where the surplus comes and then we start to dominate each other, domination is built into social progress. Because theorists, societies have told themselves constantly, look at progress. Progress is about increasing domination of the natural world. And this is what's made us so successful. That increasing domination, most in society who adhere to this view would argue, does bring with it domination of class by class, but that's okay. Because look at the progress. The progress is about constantly increasing our domination over the natural world. So the second point of this central motor for Bookchin is that we shed ourselves of this notion that domination of the natural world is in any way good for progress, is in any way possible, and is in any way an accurate reading of history. So that's the first two reasons why this central idea in blockchain is I think useful. In that second point, the idea of shedding ourselves of domination, it also brings up a whole body of literature about how our relationship to the natural world has led to the current ecological crisis, and we'll come back to that shortly, and how, in fact, solutions to the ecological crisis might be approached, again, with the notion of removing any notion of domination. Okay, and we'll come to that in a second. All right, then, the third reason why I think the central motor in Butchin's thought is really useful is that it completely directs and shapes Butchin's political programme. Okay, completely directs and shapes Butchin's political programme. Butchin's political programme and his writings on his political programme are almost as extensive as his theoretical writings. Okay, and that whole political programme, for any of you who are familiar with it, you will know, is Butchin calls communalism, or what Butchin would later call communalism, and is about working against hierarchy and domination in institutional forms wherever possible in society. Okay, so working in institutional forms at the local level against domination and hierarchy wherever possible in society. And that all comes from this idea that it's much more than difference between economic classes, much more than our domination of the natural world and progress. It's about the subjectivity of domination. When Butchin talks about his political programme, his ultimate aim, if we can see one in Butchin, is a society that's decentralised, non-hierarchical, based not on domination, but his initial aim is always about the transformation of the people involved in any particular movement. So the people involved in a project to challenge hierarchy and domination, to people involved in, a group to run a local community, to run a local cult, whatever it might be, they're the first target for Butchin. And it's about changing the mindset of the people involved in the movement. And again, many other thinkers have argued very similar, the idea of activism and perhaps revolutionary practice as educative, as transforming the people involved. Okay, in a really whistle-stop tour way, that's Butchin's broadly put understanding of social history, understanding of ecology, and it brings us up to Butchin after his major work in the early 1980s. He wrote The Ecology of Freedom, which is his major work, and published in 1982. He wrote and explained his ecological philosophy in the early 80s, from 1982 to 1985, in a series of articles. And it brings us to the point where we see, whether we agree or not, that this is quite a hefty contribution to the literature. Later, he would develop further the political programme that comes from this. However, what happened here then? Because this brings us back to the caricature. From the 80s onwards, Butchin stops being this respected figure in ecology, this respected figure in anarchism, and becomes something else. He becomes this problematic figure. At this point, we see the emergence of the literature that I identified at the beginning, that problematic literature, which I called the book Butchin Caricature. So what happened here? What went wrong? Okay. The brief story is that in the mid-1980s, there were, and they'd been emerging from the previous decade, there were the emergence of a new type of green movement, of a new type of green activist movement, new type of ecological philosophy. And they were things like the deep ecology movement. Deep ecology is based on the writings of people like Arne Naess and De Valen Sessions, a body of work that, again, dealt with humanity's problematic relation with the natural world and tried to propose an analysis and a solution to those problems. And deep ecology gives us the notion of biocentrism or ecocentrism and claims that the essential problem between humanity and nature is that we have become anthropocentric, we've become focused on ourselves, we've broken our ties with the natural world, and the only way to resolve that is a return to some kind of ecocentric philosophy that takes into account the inherent value of all other life forms. Okay? The inherent value of all other life forms. That humanity has no value above and beyond any other life form in the ecosystem. And that indeed, because of that, political programs, political forms of action have to be devised that reduce humanity's role in that schema, that reduce humanity's role to the same level of worth as other life forms. Okay, so we get the thinkers emerge. At the same time, we get the groups emerge, Earth First, in the United States in particular. Earth First starts a call for many different types of policy based on this idea. And essentially, to reduce it down, a lot of this was to do with human population. The problem with human society was wrapped up with the fact, simple fact that there were too many of us. There were too many of us, we had a problematic relationship with the natural world, we had to somehow reduce our impact and move back to a more harmonious relationship with the natural world. Later on, emerging around about the same time and becoming more popular later on, we get the emergence of things like the primitivists, who argued something similar, that we'd gone so badly wrong with human progress that we somehow had to undo it and move back. It was at this point then that Bookchin takes issue with these kind of movements. Takes issue in a conference in Amherst in Massachusetts in 1987, Bookchin delivered the keynote address, and in that keynote address, he deals with some of the, what he saw as problems of these movements. And he argued that to focus on population as a cause of the ecological crisis is to forego any analysis of history. It's not to look at what's really happened. It's to give up all agency in terms of trying to pinpoint a social solution to these crises. Okay? He argues that the population question is a complete red herring. To blame population is to blame the entirety of society, when in fact we know that the damaging forms of life that have led to the ecological crisis, and even more so in the 1980s, were the province of a very small minority of people on the planet. So Bookchin took issue with the idea that we could say that human society has become too populous, that human society has become too hurtful of the environment because of numbers, because again, very social practices that were hurting the environment were the product of a very small minority. Okay, so he takes issue with population. He takes issue with the notion of ecocentrism. Ecocentrism claims again that humans should withdraw from any kind of stewardship of providing a solution to the ecological crisis. Bookchin said this is again to forego any agency. Based on what we've seen in Bookchin's eco-philosophy, there is nothing unnatural about human society. Is the apex of this increasingly complex form of evolution, and at the apex it has a pivotal role in trying to reverse the ecological crisis. So we can see Bookchin takes issue with those things that directly chimed against, that directly went against his own philosophy. Okay, he takes issue with the notion of ecocentrism, population. He argues that if we were to go down this route, and if we were to say let's all reduce society, it actually gives us nothing concrete to work on. Bookchin's political program is a concrete program to try and overcome ecological crisis. Any other program based on ecology for Bookchin, based on ecocentrism for Bookchin, doesn't provide for a full political program. It doesn't provide for a way forward. Okay. After taking issue with the deep ecologists and other primitivist forms of organisation in the mid-1980s, the movement, or the Green Movement in particular, responds in force, and that's some of the literature I focused on earlier. But the reason I call it a caricature, the critiques that came after Bookchin's critique, the responses that accused him of bullying intellectual colonising, trying to take over ecology, trying to take over anarchism. My argument is that not one of those responses dealt with the issues Bookchin raised. So not one of those responses dealt with Bookchin's philosophy. He was dismissed as a relic of the old left, not important, but nobody, and this is what I do in the first half of the book, nobody of those thinkers actually goes back to his work to see where his critique came from. Came from this long notion of human society being a product of the natural world and having a hand, therefore, in solving the ecological crisis. A hand that Bookchin claimed, the deep ecologist denied. Okay, that brings us then to perhaps Bookchin's most famous leitmotif, and I kind of like to finish on this and open it for discussion, his famous letter of two is that all ecological problems are first and foremost social problems. All ecological problems are first and foremost social problems. And we can see what we said about his discussion of hierarchy and domination, that Butcher claims that all of our aberrant forms in society, where we started to go wrong, was amongst each other. We started to dominate each other first, and then we projected this image of domination on the natural world, and from this we have this our current problematic relationship with the natural world. Okay, so all ecological problems are first and foremost social problems, and therefore all ecological solutions for Butcher are first and foremost social solutions. Okay, and again, it's from that conclusion, from that leitmotif, it's from that that Butcher draws his critique of any notion of ecocentrism. Any notion of ecocentrism doesn't analyse the social problems that have led to the ecological problems, that have led to the ecological crisis. I've raced through that, but I think I'll leave it there. And if you want, I can then talk a little more about how I've maybe looked at the Occupy movement, Butcher and political programme.